Welcome to the CNI Conversations for October 14th, 2011. I'm Cliff Lynch, the director of CNI, and I have with me Joan Lippincott, our associate director. It's been a busy couple of weeks, and we had actually hoped to get one of these podcasts out a bit sooner than we have, but better late than never. We're at the end of a rather full week of meetings. It's Friday afternoon here, but we have quite a few things that we do want to talk about. I thought I would report on a couple of things that I've seen of interest, and then pass it over to Joan, who has a cluster of topics she wants to discuss. And then I'll conclude with a few more comments about recent meetings and previews of a few upcoming events. So let me dig in, and let me start by talking a little bit about a very nice plenary session that I saw at the American Society for Information Science and Technology. This is a project that I had actually seen before, but this plenary was an opportunity to explore it in more length. It's a project called eBird that is based out of Cornell University, and Steve Kelling, who is the director of the project, told us about it. Basically, what they have been doing at Cornell for the last few years is amassing and compiling reports of bird sightings all over the country by species, by date, by location. And actually, they have built up an enormous database at this point, which they are working, among others, with the Data One DataNet project to exploit. This permits them to do, for example, very elaborate visualizations at high resolution of the migration patterns of a given species. And, you know, it really exploits fairly high-powered computational analysis and graphical display. One of the things, though, that makes it so interesting is the crowdsourcing element, because what you've got is reports that are coming in primarily from amateur birders. And some of these birders, of course, are extremely experienced, extremely good at identifying specific species and subspecies. Others are, shall we say, a little newer at it and don't always get it right. So they've built in some fairly complex provisions for confirmation of sightings, for trying to deal with anomalies and decide whether this is really something very exciting that's genuinely anomalous or whether it's incorrect data. And I think it's a very useful window into some of the issues that come up with crowdsourcing data. Definitely recommend having a look at this if you've not seen the project before. Second thing I wanted to just say a few words about was the Internet 2 fall meeting. This is one of the two meetings a year where Internet 2 brings together the high-performance advanced networking community to get up to date on what's going on. And as many of you know, Internet 2 has gone through a lot of changes in the last year or two. They have new leadership there in the form of Dave Lambert, formerly the CIO at Georgetown University. And they have some really new things on the docket. That very week that they were meeting, they brought up the first couple of segments of their new 100 gigabit network. The amount of capacity they'll have when they get this thing built out is really quite astounding. But the other really genuinely new thing on their plate is a program to build out a Second sort of complementary network to Internet 2, which is focused on the research and education community called UCAN, which is being funded with federal money and is intended to connect up what they call community anchor institutions. These would be hospitals, museums, schools, public libraries, and similar organizations. And they're working very hard to move ahead on that, while in parallel really sort of refreshing the technology base for Internet 2. One of the other really gratifying things to see there, and I think this is one that has perhaps greater direct impact on the CNI community, was to get up to date with In Common, which is a program that really Internet 2 incubated and that now is rolling out onto its own. In Common is a sort of a clearinghouse for federated identity and attribute management, and their membership has been growing in just leaps and bounds to the point now where I think they are really pretty much at critical mass for the at least the high end of the U.S. academic community. So that was really good to see. And In Common is starting to reach out and make other connections, thinking a bit about identity management as it relates to things like discovery systems for people, projects like VIVO, or author identity management. I think there's some very good developments happening there. It's also good to see the ORCID effort at author IDs gaining some momentum as kind of a complementary activity. So lots of good news to report from that area. The last conference that I want to report on just briefly before before handing over to Joan for a bit is the TPDL meeting, Technical Principles of Digital Libraries. This conference used to be called the European Conference on Digital Libraries and brings together digital library research across Europe. It's been running for, I think, about 10 or 12 years now, although this is its first year under its new name. And I was invited to come and give one of the plenary addresses for this meeting. I spoke about the evolution of concepts of digital libraries going back to the early days of the first NSF programs and looked at some of the interplay between the technology and sociology here, the ways in which ideas about communities and sustainability got factored into digital libraries as people increasingly understood them as taking on dimensions more than strictly technical environments for analyzing and curating information. One of the real interesting things that came up both in my talk and some of the conversations thereafter, and in a number of other sessions, is the effect that Europeana is having on thinking in Europe and beyond about digital libraries. Europeana, for those who might not be familiar with it, is a very large European Union-funded system that basically federates discovery and access to out of copyright or otherwise rights cleared information that has been digitized by a number of member nations. There's a tremendous amount of material from France in there, material from Germany. There is some very interesting audio and visual material from some of the national broadcasting services in some of the participant nations. it covers not just libraries, but archives, museums, and broadcasters, and really is quite a wonderful collection of cultural material. This is really, in some ways, the first truly large-scale public access digital library system that's been deployed in Europe. Certainly some of the national libraries have done things in this area, but in many cases the content has been somewhat limited in scope. This is really a whole sort of order of magnitude bigger. And one of the things that it's done now is started to act as a focal point for triggering off serious conversations about how Europe might handle some of the challenges surrounding orphan works, for example. They're in a very different situation with orphan works, of course, because most of the European copyright laws do not have the same fair use provisions that we do in the United States. And, of course, any real solution here has to work in an international environment across a large number of countries, whereas in the U.S., we could go a long way with just a U.S.-based solution. It's been very interesting to see how this has been a focal point for a lot of development. One of the things that I got a lot of questions about and that did figure a bit in my talk was the Digital Public Library of America, so-called, or DPLA, as it sometimes is referred to. And the Europeans are very curious about this. They've seen some sort of high-level stuff, some of the editorials and things, but they're really finding it hard to get a handle on what it's liable to be like, the extent to which it might be similar to their Europeana effort. I have to say, and I'm not really close to the deliberations about how to shape the DPLA, that I can certainly envision a potential Public Library of America, and I do think we need to work on that name. Perhaps we could call it Americana or something, in tribute to the European contribution and echoing it, and see the construction of a sort of a portal and a discovery aggregator to the very rich collections of out-of-copyright material that are held by governments, institutions like the Smithsonian and the Library of Congress, and also encompass some of the major university out-of-copyright materials, perhaps the out-of-copyright works from the HathiTrust, for example. That was very interesting to see those kinds of discussions and see the way Europeana has altered the European landscape. I think at this point I'm going to pass the conversation over to Joan Lippincott, and then I'll conclude with a few other reports.
Thanks, Cliff. I've been interested in generational differences in use of information and technology for a number of years, and I try to keep up with writings or talks on that topic. But I want to address a few recent things, but I'm going to start with an anecdote. Recently, I was in a shuttle van on the way to an airport, and the only other passengers were a couple well into their 80s. In fact, they looked a bit frail. They were discussing their visit with family members, and at one point, the wife said wistfully, "I'm going to miss Tommy so much." Trying to be sympathetic, her husband replied, "Don't worry, dear. You'll see him soon on Skype." I was taken aback and amused at these octogenarians' use of Skype in such an offhanded way, but it reminded me that we need to be nuanced in our thinking about generational differences in relation to technology. Now, On the other hand, two recent reports did highlight generational differences. A recent study found key differences in age groups regarding use of text messaging. The Pew Internet and American Life Project reported on September 19th that those in the 18 to 29 age group sent a startling median of 40 text messages per day, while those in the 50 to 64 year old age group, the baby boomers, sent a median of only 3 per day. Another example I learned about recently had to do with placing political ads on television. In a story on NPR's All Things Considered on September 26th, the reporter talked about some survey results by two political pollsters. One of the pollsters said, "The number one finding in the survey, which really shocked me, is that 31% of voters we talked to said they had not watched live TV in the past week." Live in this case doesn't mean a live event like a baseball game. It means watching a TV program when a channel or network airs it. So if about a third of TV viewers only watched recorded programming in the previous week, there's no reason to assume they sat through the commercials. That's what the fast forward button is for. You do a little deeper dive in the data, and there's not a gender difference, there's not a partisan difference, Republicans versus Democrats, not really an educational difference. Where there's a real difference is a generation difference. The generation gap is stark and wide. Younger people are much less likely to watch TV in real time, or even to watch television on a television. They may find computers or smartphones more convenient. And so I think the lessons here are that as we roll out services to users, we need to take into account the generational differences. And of course, on many of our university and higher ed campuses, we have a variety of generations in our student bodies, and we need to take account of their needs. But that takes me to my second topic, which is assessment, specifically knowing your user community. Shar Booth, who's now of the Claremont College's libraries and formerly of UC Berkeley, has worked with the Council of Chief Librarians of California Community Colleges to develop a user survey that could eventually scale up to all 112 California community colleges. And very recently, they concluded a pilot with five colleges to understand their technology and library use. Some of the interesting findings were that the participants rated their information search abilities in an open web context significantly higher than their library research abilities. Another one is that students accessed course readings using an array of web, commercial, library-provided, and informal methods. Looking at more technology-oriented questions, students valued their technology skill development at the college. They wanted that to be part of their education. Their information technology use was perceived as a positive factor in learning, academic productivity, and collaboration. And finally, social and multimedia platforms were often used in the context of coursework. And so I think that this gives us a very interesting picture of the students in this sample. Shar describes a lot more about this study in detail on her blog called Informational, and we'll include a link to that on our podcast website. In her blog post, you'll also find a link to the survey template, which can be used and adapted by other institutions. Also, in looking at user studies, this week, Project Information Literacy from the University of Washington iSchool released another in its series of reports documenting and analyzing student information-seeking behavior, competencies, and attitudes. And this recent report examines how students use libraries and technology during crunch time, the final week of the academic term. Some of the context is that the researchers are trying to understand the nature of multitasking among students, and also whether technology assists them or distracts them during an intense academic period. Here's a quote from the report. "All in all, our findings suggest that students, while in the library, may be trying to mindfully manage technology when the pressure is at its most intense, using practical and reliable methods to harness IT devices for working more efficiently, staying focused on coursework, conserving their ever-dwindling time, and still remaining connected to the people in their lives, mostly through social networking." I found the studies from this project, Information Literacy, to be very illuminating and encourage you to take a look at their reports. We'll have links to the NPR story, the Pew Report, Charbooth's blog, and Project Information Literacy on the podcast website. And in the next CNI Conversations, I plan to continue talking about the theme of assessment, but in the context of learning spaces. Back over to you, Cliff.
Thanks for that. There's some fascinating data in there, it's really helpful, I think, always to have real hard data there, because there is so much characterization and sweeping generality that isn't supported by that kind of real rigorous data analysis. I just have a couple more things that I want to say a word about. About midday today, Joan and I finished the Association of Research Libraries, CNI, symposium, which we do in October following the Association of Research Libraries membership meeting. And this year, we really looked at 21st century collections, their nature, their scope, their variation, trying rather than to go in great detail into specific issues like the changing nature and role of special collections or e-science and data-intensive scholarship and the implications of data curation there. Instead, this symposium really tried to look broadly across the range of developments and to really challenge libraries to think about a sort of a portfolio approach about the sort of proportion of resource that should be allocated to different parts of the collection strategy in the 21st century, how you get from here to there through gradual reallocation. Also to try and understand where collaboration played a role, where you might be able to get leverage through multi-institutional strategies, through collaborations with scholars, collaborations with the audience for some of these materials, or with students or others through crowdsourcing type approaches that we've talked about in the past. I think it was really quite a helpful seminar, symposium, and we should have the PowerPoints and the recordings of the talks up on ARL's website fairly soon. I'll put out an announcement to CNI Announce when those are ready. Some of the conversations there of particular note would include Paul Duguid, my colleague from the School of Information at UC Berkeley, giving this morning's keynote, a wonderful panel following that this morning that included a look at crowdsourcing applications, among other things. A very, very lively closing session that included the president of the Louisiana State University System making some very, very blunt comments about his views on collaboration and when it was and was not something that was saleable to senior leadership. So lots of interesting material there. And I think people will find that helpful in thinking about the shape of future collections. Joan and I will both be at the EDUCAUSE meeting in Philadelphia next week, and for those at EDUCAUSE, we hope to see you there. We will be doing a community update on CNI in the afternoon of Thursday, October 19th. Finally, I'll just mention in closing that I'm also going to be doing the McCusker Lecture at the Dominican University near Chicago on October 26th in the evening, where I'm going to lay out some thoughts about names and biographies in the digital world. And that is a public lecture for those in the Chicago area who'd like to join us. And I do hope to also write that lecture up in future. The final thing I want to do is just look a little bit farther ahead to the upcoming CNI meeting in December. We're still taking in and amassing some wonderful proposals for breakout sessions. The call for that will remain open a little longer, and so I'm not ready to talk about a preview of the breakouts yet, but we have now got our closing plenary speaker confirmed. That's going to be Jim Duderstadt, the President Emeritus of the University of Michigan. Jim, for those who aren't familiar with his work, has been a major strategic thinker about the future of the research university, and in particular the role that information technology is likely to play in reshaping the research university. He led a National Academy study on information technology in the research university that produced a report around 2005, I believe, and has been participating in a recent Academy study looking more broadly at the future of the research university. I'm hopeful that he will share some of the findings and deliberations of that panel with us as part of his remarks at the CNI meeting. So that should be a really, really interesting closing plenary. And with that, I think we've covered everything we're going to talk about today. I hope to see some of you at the upcoming EDUCAUSE meeting or other events, and we'll look forward to doing another one of these podcasts soon. Thanks for joining us today.